The gospel lesson this morning is drawn from chapter 9 of Mark's gospel, and it is the story of the transfiguration. Let us listen for good news. And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain apart by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. And his garments became glistening, intensely white, as no fuller on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, and they were talking to Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it is well that we are here. Let us make 3 booths, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah." For he did not know what to say, for they were exceedingly afraid. And a cloud overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud, "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him." And suddenly, looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them, but Jesus only. And as they were coming down the mountain, he charged them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man should have risen from the dead. May we be blessed in the hearing of this good news. Pray with me, please. O God, in whom there is no shadow of darkness, O God of light and strength and hope, open our minds and our hearts, that as Jesus was transfigured on the mountain, so we may be transfigured each day and become transparent, so that your good news, your good work, your great love may shine through us as it shone through him. Open us now to hear this good word and to understand it together. In Christ's name, amen. Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain apart by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. What does it mean to be transfigured? The word itself comes from the Latin translation of the Greek word metamorphosis, and it means a change in figure or in shape. I like what Webster's Ninth Collegiate Dictionary says it means: transform outwardly, and usually for the better. Traditional Christian teaching sees the transfiguration of Christ as a foreshadowing of the resurrection, which is why it is commemorated by most Protestant churches on the last Sunday before Lent begins. It also carries with it the hope that every Christian, every person, can be transformed for the better. To my mind, this is also a story of what it means to be a part of the emerging church. As Peter and James and John saw Jesus for who he really was at that moment, so we, the church, are to allow the light of God's presence to shine through us. There's the old saying about the church always reforming. Well, I've come to the conclusion that the church is also always emerging. For the record, however, Peter and James and John didn't really get who Jesus was. For that matter, neither did the rest of the disciples. Though I suppose with the discovery of this new text I read about this week, attributed to Judas Iscariot, scholars will have a field day trying to do some rehabilitation. We'll just have to wait and see on that one. Still, we can't get away from the reality that Jesus' earthly ministry was one marked by misunderstanding, by conflict, by fear, and even by betrayal. And as it moved toward its conclusion, there was this moment on the mountaintop, a moment of promise, a sign of hope. The 3 disciples who were up there weren't there because they merited the favor, not because they got it. Even as they behold the blinding revelation and hear the heavenly voice, they don't get it. They misunderstand what's going on around them. Peter's stumbling words about it being good to be there, so let's just stay here and build booths, certainly testify to a lack of insight on his part. Nevertheless, the voice calls them to listen. They get a glimpse of glory, a foreshadowing of the resurrection. And like everyone who has ever had a mountaintop spiritual experience, they're called to go back down the mountain into a confused and hurting world. I think that's why I wanted to talk about the emerging church today. This passage and the experience of Peter and James and John, because they still didn't get it. Even after they had heard the voice and glimpsed the glory, biblical scholar Deborah Krauss says of their experience, "This gift, however, is not an inoculation against further misunderstanding and faithlessness. These three disciples are a part of the group that entirely abandons Jesus as he is arrested and put on trial. Even though they don't get it, even though they run away, there is still good news. There is still the call to transformation. There is still the possibility of new life. And thank God, that remains the case for the church today. There are always new opportunities for faith. There are always new opportunities to get it. And these are emerging even in the midst of hard-heartedness and misunderstanding. As the church is always reforming, so too, it is always emerging. Coming to this realization has fueled my own fascination with the so-called emergent church movement. This movement seeks to make vintage Christianity, I loved that term, vintage Christianity, available to new generations. It doesn't see the need to abandon the traditional approach to Christian life and worship in order to appeal to a secular society. They don't see the need to pull down meeting houses and build shopping mall lookalikes with food courts in their places. I like that. Rather, this movement looks to an intense recovery of those things, particularly a life of faithful discipleship, which formed Christian faith at its core. Dan Kimball is engaged in this movement, and he's written a book called The Emerging Church, Vintage Christianity for New Generations, which describes this movement and its goals. At the outset of the book, he tells the story of a young man, and I love the way he described him. He said he was an artist type out in California wearing long sideburns and retro polyester. Sounds like people I went to high school with. And this young man stood up in front of a group of peers to tell them why he wasn't a Christian. Now, reading that section of the book touched me very deeply, and I'd like to share that passage with you. I think you're going to hear echoes of things perhaps that you've heard before, and I would bet you dollars to donuts you've even thought of yourself. And this young man's name was Sky. That's how I know I didn't go to high school with him. We didn't have people named Sky when I was in high school. Well, it shows you how old I am. First, Sky says this, "Christianity is a man-made organized religion." Sky shared how he was raised in a non-religious home. His parents, who had divorced when he was young, never encouraged him to attend church. In fact, they were rather distrustful of Christians and had rejected the church. As Sky grew up, he was taught by his parents to intelligently think for himself, and his own observations led him to believe that Christianity was a man-made, organized religion filled with man-made rules based on opinions and politics. The second thing Sky said, "Christians are close-minded, judgmental people." From all he had experienced, Sky felt that most Christians were closed-minded and judgmental. Christian, whether the issue was sexual, ethical, or moral preferences, Christians were always ready to point out how others were wrong and how they were always right. He shared how he strongly felt it was silly for the church in this age to cling to its dogmatic opinions. He felt that Christians were very shallow thinkers to believe that they had the only true answers. The third thing he said, "Christians are arrogant to think they alone have the only true religion." Sky shared that in his viewpoint, all religions and worldviews should be considered of equal value and beauty. He felt that the criticism and condemnation he had heard Christians inflict on non-believers was harmful and inexcusable. He shared that it really is arrogant to think that Christians alone have the one true religion and the only way to God. For all of these reasons, he testified that he not only rejected Christianity, but was actually repelled by it. Although he described himself as a very spiritual person, he made it clear that Christianity was one of the last religions he would ever consider following. He offered his perspective on Christians as a word of caution to those there that night, lest they make these mistakes in their interactions with others like him. 2 years later, that same young man stood in front of that group, this time to talk about why he was becoming a Christian and receiving baptism. His story involved, and this I love his description, some, quote, very different and unusual people who touched his life. He said that he had finally seen Jesus shine through the lives of those who claimed to be his followers, and that's what drew him. I believe that this is the essence of what it means to be the emerging church, to be what we covenant to be as followers of Jesus Christ, and then to let it show in every aspect of our lives. Peter and James and John and the other disciples experienced a transformation in their lives because they entered into a relationship with God, a relationship that was revealed in the loving words, in the loving actions, and in the loving life of Jesus. It's that relationship that makes the difference. It's that relationship which makes the transforming moment for good and which can touch people's lives and bring them to a new level of self-awareness and, yes, of other awareness as well. I want to illustrate this reality by taking a bit of a different tack and looking at an unusual Christ figure in a movie that I found almost mesmerizing, Chocola. Remember it? It's just another case of very different and unusual people making a difference when you get right down to it. It's the truth that God writes straight with crooked lines. Chocola takes place in a small town in France in 1959. The town has always expressed their community life using the word tranquillité, tranquility. You knew what was expected of you. You knew what your place was. And if you happened to forget, someone would remind you, especially the Count de Renault, the mayor. They trusted the wisdom of ages past. They lived with the values of tradition, family, and morality. My goodness, sounds like Wauwatosa, doesn't it? Into this town comes Vien, played by Juliette Binoche. She does not go to church. She has a daughter without a father present and has the gall to open a chocolaterie. This has really tested my French. Right in the middle of Lent, as she opens and conducts her business, it becomes clear that she's anything but traditional. Vien does nothing by the book. She does nothing out of obligation, but everything out of love. It is her encouragement that brings Josephine out of her abusive marriage. It is her encouragement that brings Armand, played fetchingly by Judi Dench, together with her grandson. It is her encouragement that brings a widow of 30-some years out of mourning and into a new relationship. It is her boldness that even touches the Count de Renault after what can only be described as a chocolate-inspired mental meltdown. That's one of the great scenes of all time. I love that scene. And brings him to a new sense of self and of love. The town is transformed by her chocolaterie and her grace. Now, note what's gone on there. There has been a web of relationship developed, and ultimately the rigidity, the coldness that had bound that town gave way and opened it up. I think Chocolat and Babette's Feast are little theological masterpieces of film, not just because of the food focus, mind you, but because they expose the wonder of relationship and the wonder of self-giving love. It's sad, however, that in both of those films, that the church comes off in the way that it does, especially in Chocolat through most of the film. However, thank God, even the young parish priest who's had to suffer the mayor's editing and rewriting his sermons to make them more sternly moralistic preaches an Easter sermon which really celebrates the resurrection and the transformation that it can bring to our lives right here, right now. And I suppose that's the point of the emerging church, that we get out of the way and allow the Spirit of God to bring those core teachings, the real meaning of what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ, to come through, to emerge, to rise to the surface where they can really make a difference. The story of Elijah and Elisha that we read from 2 Kings has traditionally been seen by the church as a transformation, as a foreshadowing of this transfiguration story. And it's also seen as symbolic of the handing on of tradition. As the mantle is passed from Elijah to Elisha, so the authoritative word continues, even in the physical absence of the one who spoke it. In Christian tradition, the hope is that what was true of Elijah is also true of Jesus. This is what Mark is trying to convey when Moses and Elijah appear on the mountain with Jesus. Moses and Elijah are the prophets par excellence. And Jesus is shown to be in that line, bringing the law and the prophets to a whole new level. Even though they don't get it, the disciples are like Elisha, who also, by the way, didn't get it. And that the mantle of carrying the word of presence will pass to them and through them to us, to all of the followers of Jesus of all time. Now, First Church may not look like many of the emerging churches described in Kimball's book, but I think we're among them. Congregationalists, when we're true to our tradition, understand that the mantle passes to all believers and that the covenant relationship calls us to make the love of Christ present in daily life, not just in the mountaintop experiences of worship gathered in the meeting house. We come unveiled, as Paul says, because nothing stands between us and the presence of God. We call God into our presence and God comes. We are, all of us, responsible for the continuously emerging church, letting the presence of Jesus shine through us, transforming us, usually, hopefully, for good. It is my prayer that we not block this presence or that we obscure it, as too often happens. How can we achieve this task of being the emerging church? I think it goes back to the emphasis on vintage Christianity. It's about the basics. It's about the core teaching of our faith, understanding that God's love is real, that God's love is available, and then making it present through our words and through our actions. In short, living it out in relationship. Again, my two favorite words, intentionality and mutuality, apply here. We must be intentional. Every day, reminding ourselves of who we are, of what we're about, and equipping ourselves through study and prayer and practice to live as followers of Jesus Christ. And we must be mutual, understanding that we don't do this as lone rangers, that to be Christian means to live in community and to do so through fellowship, which, by the way, goes deeper than a cup of coffee following worship. Although that's good too. And that fellowship touches people. It touches people in both good times and in bad, welcoming the stranger and seeing to those in need. Further, it's opening ourselves to get it, to become aware of God's presence and work among us. There is wisdom in practice counseled both by Ignatius of Loyola and our Puritan forebears, called the daily examination of conscience. Right before bed, take some time and be honest with yourself. Look for the places where God was present and what our response was. Were we open to God-given opportunities? Did we see Christ in the needy and the hurting? Did we overlook callings and turn a deaf ear to those little holy nudges that come our way? The goal of the daily examination isn't guilt. It's not about beating ourselves up, but to train ourselves to be more observant, to be more sensitive and more aware to God's presence in the ordinary and in the everyday. I believe that being part of the emerging church means opening ourselves to the hidden glory of God, the hidden glory of God within ourselves and within those around us. It's about seeing God in the heart of the ordinary. every time we gather in this place of meeting and open ourselves to the transfiguring presence of God, God comes. And the mantle is passed and the possibility of new life continues. Then we have the next part. We have to go down the mountain. We have to make it real. We have to make it real in our homes. We have to make it real in our businesses. We have to make it real in everything that we do. And that's what it means to be transfigured. When our being followers of Jesus Christ shows through every day. When the veil of our all too real humanity is pierced by the shining love of God, and people know it, people feel it. People are drawn to these different and unusual people. There is transfiguration. There is hope. And there is the emerging church. May it be so.